Next up on This Week in Law, we've got copyright librarian Nancy Sims joining Evan Brown and me. And we've got trolls. We've got copyright trolls. We've got patent trolls. We've got geckos fighting trolls. We're going to get away from some trollishness as well. Talk about George W. Bush as a potential warrior for fair use. We're going to talk about windowing and lessons to be learned in ebook contracts. Also, a bit of Heartbleed for you, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 254, recorded April 11th, 2014. Girl Scout cookies in September. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by NatureBox, where you can order great-tasting, healthy snacks delivered right to your door. Forget the vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like Cherry Berry Bonanza. To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. Hello, you've tuned into This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell. I'm here with my co-host, Evan Brown. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Great to see you on this Friday afternoon.
Great to see you, too. We have a great guest with us this week to talk about everything new, exciting, and interesting at the intersection of technology and law. And specifically, we're going to focus on a lot of copyright stuff today because we have an infamous copyright librarian joining us from the University of Minnesota. We have Nancy Sims. Hello, Nancy.
Hello. Thanks for having me. Very excited to chat.
Great to have you. So Evan and I have followed you on Twitter for some time. Give us your background for those who haven't yet been following you on Twitter.
Sure. I am an academic librarian. I call myself a lawyer-brarian because I'm not a law librarian, which is a pretty big distinction for me. I got into libraries actually primarily out of a background in loving to play around with computers. So my first library jobs were all technology oriented. I did a lot of work in my first job helping people understand how to use software. It was at an academic library. So how to use software in various applications in their academic work, scanning pictures, you know, preparing conference posters. And things just kept coming up like, hey, I want to use a video clip in my class. Well, if you rip it off of a VHS tape, we only have to worry about copyright. If you rip it off of a DVD, we have to worry about copyright and this thing called the DMCA. So with all of that stuff that kept coming up in my work, I decided to go to law school. And I finished law school in 2009 and have been working specifically on copyright issues ever since.
That's wonderful. Well, I think we'll start out with some copyright issues to kick off the show.
Okay.
Wiki, wiki, wiki. I always love the little scratching there at the end of our bumper. Let's start off talking about something that I first spotted in Nancy's Twitter stream this week. And that has to do with Creative Commons licensing and Flickr, which has been a big champion of Creative Commons licensing over the years. And one of the best implementations of Creative Commons licensing, I think, for people to be able to choose a license and apply it to their photos and then communicate the fact that their photos are licensed and make sure that the license travels with their photos as people go ahead and reuse them around the web. But recently, there was a little bump in the road there. Nancy, can you tell us what happened?
Sure. Yahoo redesigned the Flickr interface recently, and they really did top to bottom. They've been doing some major redesigns of photo streams basically for a while, but the most recent thing they really, really overhauled was the individual photo page. And one of the things that happened was that it became much less clear what Creative Commons license was being applied to any given picture. So this is actually an image from my own photo stream. I use Flickr a lot and I use Creative Commons licenses. Anything that I share on Flickr is Creative Commons licensed. when they first did this redesign, it just showed some rights reserved. They're also, you can see on the screen, they're not using the standard Creative Commons icons for which license is chosen. This image is licensed with a Creative Commons attribution only license. And you can't tell that just from looking at this. Another thing that changed with the redesign is it's a lot harder to figure out how to download the image. If it's Creative Commons licensed, I want you to be able to download it, but it's a lot harder to do that in this redesign. They have changed some things. They have fixed some things based on feedback from people who use Flickr. And so now if you click on the Some Rights Reserved link, it actually does take you to the full Creative Commons license. It does, if you mouse over it, you can see that it's an attribution-only license. So you can actually tell now which Creative Commons license is being applied just on looking on the page. One of the other things that broke, though, was the metadata surrounding the image. There, lots and lots of sites use the Creative Commons metadata that Flickr supplies for image search engines, and also some really nifty little various types of applets that create attributions or citations for you. So all of those broke when Flickr redesigned because they dropped the standard metadata. As I understand it, they have put that metadata back, but I haven't tried any of the citation applets yet to see if they're still working right.
Okay, and do you know if it Flickr's own search was impacted by this at all?
As far as I could tell, when I tried searching through this, you could still search by Creative Commons license, and their search doesn't actually let you choose, you know, all of the combinations. Their advanced search lets you search for Creative Commons licensed images, for images that are commercially reusable, and I can't remember what the third factor is. But they so their search continued to work. But the challenge is that since you couldn't tell what specific license was granted on a particular image, some of those searches return images with different licenses, and you couldn't tell which one of the licenses was available, and you couldn't easily download it. I will say the new redesign still makes it very difficult to download the picture. I expect to be able to right-click on a picture and save the image file. In order to actually get to the picture in the new redesign, you still have to find which of the sort of random icons on the page is for more, and then from the more page you can download it. So it's still a little bit harder to use than I want for my Creative Commons images. But there are not a whole lot of other photo sharing sites that support them particularly well either. So,
yeah, and that is totally random. And you have to click on that ellipsis, you know, like the little three dots, and that brings up, you know, a lot of choices that, you know, I don't know if many of those choices are new in the redesign, but there's certainly another layer and a rather opaque layer at that, isn't there, to get to the interface where you can actually download the images, right? Isn't it where that little ellipsis is?
It is. It's the little ellipsis, and I had to click around on all of those icons before I figured out one download option. There's the download / all sizes thing. On the old individual image view, all sizes was a link you could see on the basic page and right-clicking on the image on the basic page unless the user had chosen some options that are incompatible with Creative Commons licensing, I think. Right-clicking on the image allowed you to download that image too. So they've disabled the right-clicking on the image, and you have to find which of the random icons leads to the all sizes page in order to download the image still, even though they've fixed it.
Mm-hmm. Wonder if that was intentional. I mean, to make it a little more difficult, because there you could see countervailing arguments where, you know, for one thing, they may be trying to, well, and granted, it would still be a mistake if they're doing it to restrict the downloading of Creative Commons images, because the assumption is people who license their work by through Creative Commons want it to be downloaded so that it can be reused in the way that the license granted. But, you know, from a more general standpoint for images that aren't protected by Creative Commons, you kind of wonder if there's an attempt here to nod toward having Flickr be a service where it is, you know, where it's primarily used for people to go online to look at the images, not as a place to go and find images that you can download to look at later, but in a general sense, just sort of, you know, a cloud service or like a video streaming service would be, a change in the mindset, trying to force a change in the mindset of the users as to where the images are stored, what the location's going to be. You know, it seems like there could be some good design sensibilities about this in a larger sense. Do you Do you agree, or is it just totally bogus all the way around?
I think Flickr is trying to do, trying to serve a couple of audiences that may have some really incompatible interests. Flickr for Creative Commons photos has been, you know, that was part of their early design. I've met some of their early designers and early people who were working on the interface, and they were really into open technologies. And that was part of why they built in support for Creative Commons licenses so early. I think with the Yahoo redesigns lately, one of the things that's really clear is that they're looking to be more graphically compelling. They've got all these really cool tiled things where you can see your images and control them. This thing that we're seeing right now is kind of the old style Flickr, but the newer style, if you click on someone's photo stream, you'll see it's sort of waterfall look. It's much more responsive design. And that kind of stuff is definitely going to appeal to photographers who might be using Flickr for less to share and more to provide access to their work, but not necessarily full downloads of all their work. I think that's a split that, that Flickr has been supporting pretty well for a while, because in the previous iteration, one option that people could choose was to disable right-clicking on their pictures. I mean, if you want to use Flickr to share pictures, but you don't really want to use Flickr to let people download your pictures, they had an option that already existed to disable right-clicking. You know, disabling right-clicking only works as far as the users understand how not to route around it. It's only a limited option. But that's certainly something that some photographers did choose to use on Flickr a lot. So I think they do have some competing audiences, and this redesign might be a sign of them choosing to go towards a direction that's away from some of their more Creative Commons-minded users and towards some of the people who are more interested in limiting access to their works. But it may also just be that they are being managed by a different group of people than the folks who originally started Flickr, and they may not be as aware of how compelling people find the Creative Commons parts of Flickr. So it may just be that they're not quite as aware of their audience there.
Yeah, I think that Flickr definitely has that tension in its user base, and that the feature where you could turn off downloading entirely is still there. And it would seem like that would be enough of a draw for those who don't want their images downloaded. It seems like disabling the right click might be overkill, especially because they've got, you know, such a strong contingent of people using Creative Commons licensing on their photos. I know I do there too.
Do either of you have any data about what kind of percentage of the photos on Flickr are licensed by Creative Commons?
I know I looked at that a couple of years ago, but I really don't remember if I could find details. I mean, the Creative Commons page on Flickr that we were looking at a couple minutes ago does say how many images they have in certain categories, and the numbers are astronomical. I mean, stock photographers are right to feel a little threatened by Creative Commons photo licensing, but I don't know percentage-wise what percentage of Flickr is open licensed.
And even more importantly, I think rather than trying to establish the importance of Creative Commons on Flickr, it'd be more important to just note how, at least historically, Flickr has been good for Creative Commons, making it easy, allowing the third-party development that Cory guy, not Cory Doctorow, but the Cory Dot that Cory Doctorow talks about in the article on Boing Boing, who created that script, that applet, you know, the attributor is what it was called.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems more important than just looking at the raw data of how many photos are on Flickr in proportion to it, because to just recognize that Flickr is so pro Creative Commons, such a good avenue for it.
All right. Well, let's move on from Flickr and talk about trolls for a moment. Check in with what's been going on with Prenda Law. You know that it lost a bunch of lawsuits on a number of fronts and got, you know, the lawyers got sanctioned, and definitely nothing good has been happening for Prenda. That trend seems to be like it could be continuing. There was an oral argument in the appeal of one of the Prenda cases recently, And while it's dangerous to try and ballpark an outcome from the oral argument, apparently the justices of the judges, the appeals judges of the Seventh Circuit were not having a whole lot of sympathy for the Prenda side of things. Evan, this is in your neck of the woods. Were you paying attention to this Prenda case getting argued?
The only attention I pay to Prenda now is just as entertainment. You know, back in the glory days, starting in 2010, when John Steele and company started actually filing these crazy lawsuits, I represented a lot of the John Doe defendants in these. So now it's sort of lost its luster for me. So I just look at it and sort of enjoy seeing where it's going. And what we get from the arguments in front of the Seventh Circuit is just more of a illustration of how the shell game, that's not my term, that's what, you know, it's, I think maybe the court used that, or certainly what Joe Mullen, who is a friend of the show, has been on before, used it in the Ars piece talking about that. I mean, it is looking more and more like it was just this amazingly complex system of evasiveness that Steele, Hansmeier, Duffy, Mark Lutz was, I guess he was a paralegal. It wasn't ever clear what his role in was with all of this, but he did a lot of communications on behalf of the firm du jour, whether it was Prenda Law, whether it was Steele Hansmeier, whether it was, what were some of the AF Holdings, I guess was the name of a plaintiff. It looks like it may actually have some legal relationship with Prenda Law, which is one of the things that they're trying to unravel here. So it certainly does look bad when these issues that don't relate necessarily to the underlying merits of the case, but the court making the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals making inquiry as to the business structure of the different firms and the relationships of the attorneys to those firms, when the lawyer representing the Prenda Law can't even explain the legal relationships between all of those things. That looks pretty bad under any set of standards, how you're going to evaluate the situation. And you know, we know that where there's smoke, there's fire. So the analogy would be where there are indications of fraud, there's probably fraud. So I'm just saying that in the abstract. We don't know exactly what all has gone on here, but certainly doesn't look good for Prenda and company. And it's starting to fill in the gaps of put the color in the picture that we've been able to sketch out of these guys over the past few years and some of their business practices that don't look all that scrupulous. So it's good stuff. It's entertaining.
Yeah. I think this is the first time a court of appeal has gotten a hold of some of the rulings adverse to Prenda. So we'll have to see what exactly happens following the argument, what the court of appeal actually decides here. I don't know if we've talked about someone who doesn't like to be referred to as a copyright troll, but sometimes is, Malibu Media, which runs an adult site called XArt. They have sued over 1,000 internet users. And, you know, they fall in the category of copyright trolls, if we can call them that, who might be able to use intimidation tactics based on the nature of the content that they have under copyright. People might be embarrassed to be identified as someone who is guilty of infringing their copyright. So in fighting the copyright troll label and trying to justify the merits of their lawsuits, they're over at the Copyright Trolls blog, some documentation came to light that they had filed that talked about the due diligence that they're doing, such as administering lie detector tests to defendants to see whether or not that they'd actually downloaded any of the copyrighted material. That seems like something that is not part of standard discovery, Evan, and I'm curious to get your take on that.
On lie detector tests?
Yes, these tactics in general.
That seems like some civil litigation that could be pretty darned exciting. You know, we need to get a piece of that, right? That sounds pretty cool. So, Yeah. I mean, on this whole issue of Malibu Media, I mean, this is another company that I certainly have had a lot of exposure to, representing John Doe defendants who've gotten letters either from Malibu directly or from the ISPs who are the subject of Malibu Media's discovery efforts here. So on the whole question of the semantics of troll, or, you know, what constitutes trollism, you know, what have you here, I think that's kind of a silly discussion to be having. You can understand why Malibu Media might want to distance itself from the negative connotation that the word troll engenders. But, you know, it doesn't change the fact that the underlying motivation or the underlying sensibilities that is causing Malibu Media to engage in widespread litigation against unknown defendants and over subject matter where, if it is made public that these defendants are accused of trading this content, it's going to be embarrassing to them. You know, that this is pornography, we can't forget. And so that's embarrassing to a lot of people if that's made a matter of public record, or even if their family or friends find out that they're accused of trading in pornography online. The whole point, it doesn't change the fact that there's just something that's unsavory about those sensibilities, that strategy and those tactics that they use. So the fact that they are using lie detector tests just plays right into that. Lie detector tests plays right into that as a tactic of, look at this, you know, this crazy slimy type of plaintiff is doing this stuff. And, you know, we've got to stop and put it in proper perspective. I mean, they're not getting court orders requiring these people to undertake lie detector tests. These are things that defendants are doing probably from a sense of desperation. Say, hey, I'll take a lie detector test. I didn't trade this file. So, you know, it just plays into the narrative really well and sort of adds to the story here. So, with all that said, you know, I can kind of see the point of what Malibu Media is trying to make, is that they're not trolls in the same sense that a patent troll is. You know, purportedly, if they truly are a real pornographer, if they are actually out there generating content and putting it into the marketplace, that's a little bit different than what we see with patent trolls, who just merely hold those rights and don't do anything. So you can sort of see the differences, but I still stand by what I said earlier. That it doesn't change the fact that the underlying motivation is just sort of like, we don't like to see that kind of stuff.
Right. And Joe Mullen wrote up over at Ars Technica the piece on Malibu Media and is quoting from the FCT blog, which estimates that Malibu Media may have gotten up to 1 million in settlements from the 174 settlements it has reported. In the range of $2,000 to $10,000 a piece. Nancy, do you think the copyright troll problem is getting better or worse?
Well, you know, it depends on what you call a troll. Copyright owners, or at least alleged copyright owners, you know, Prenda has had some trouble proving certain elements of that even. Copyright owners suing consumers is... it seems to have been kind of going in waves a little bit. You know, the music industry tried it for a while. They got lots of settlements out of people. They also got a lot of negative press out of that. And then the music industry has moved away from that model. Then we saw some attempts to do that with movies. And then we've also seen this sort of troll model with Prenda of, we think maybe, and this has just been alleged, I don't know the details of all the facts, where there are some people who we think are seeding torrents and then going after the people who download the torrents. That's a little different than what the music companies were doing. I mean, they're definitely legitimate content producers suing their users. But it's an interesting development in the law. And really, I mean, one of the things that when I'm talking with people, I'm often talking with like K-12 teachers about copyright, and they're really worried about it. And one of the reasons people are so much more scared about copyright issues is because content owners sue users now. And that's a new thing. And it's partly because the technology enables content owners to see what individual users are doing in ways that analog technologies never used to do. And it's a really interesting social evolution where the technological change has actually led to some changes in legal practices that really affect how we feel about the law in our daily lives. And I think that's one of the really negative outcomes of these troll cases, and of any system of copyright enforcement where content owners are mass suing users, that people feel a lot less good about copyright. Individual consumers, who are also creators, by the way, feel a lot less good about copyright. And overall, it kind of undermines the system.
Yep, excellent point. Let's move on to another area that can be really problematic as technologies come online that might not have existed when contracts were drafted. We've seen over and over again that digital rights may not have been contemplated when somebody originally authored a work. And our former intern, Franklin Graves, has written up a great post on his blog, which is called A Law Student's Digital Mark, about an ebook deal that involved that very issue, had to do with a book called, let's see, Julie of the Wolves, where ebook rights were granted, I think, to one party, but the original publisher claimed, no, no, we have all those rights under our publishing agreement, even though it wasn't specifically spelled out. In fact, ebooks didn't even exist in 1971 when the contract was drafted. So they wound up in court over this, and the court decided that something called the doctrine of new use would come into play in interpreting the contract here. So even though ebooks were not around and were not specifically mentioned in the original publishing agreement, that was determined to be not a problem, and that the rights that were under those under the original HarperCollins 1971 agreement swept that in. Nancy, is this problematic?
I think actually, as the blog post points out, this is an example of a really well-drafted contract. I'm not actually familiar with the doctrine of new use, but the words quoted in this blog post anyway are that the contract transferred the rights to publish the book in book form and in electronic means now known or hereinafter invented. And that kind of language in the 70s was not terribly common in contracts, but is increasingly really common in content contracts. This case made me think of another one from a few years back, which is the Ticini case. This was when the New York Times started licensing its content out to database aggregators like Lexis and ProQuest and folks like that. People who had independently contracted with the New York Times over individual articles, so not staff reporters, but independent contractors who had provided content to the New York Times, they said, hey, wait a minute, we did not give you the right to do this. And the New York Times, in examining their contracts, I don't know the details of the actual language of those contracts, but those contracts didn't have a forward-looking clause like that. So the argument the New York Times ended up relying on was, well, you gave us the rights to put it in a compilation, and compilation copyrights usually extend to new editions of the compilation, and these databases are new editions of our compilation. So they never, the original contracts didn't grant electronic rights to the New York Times, so the New York Times had to argue it's part of a compilation, and the electronic version of the compilation is just the same as the paper version. And the court didn't buy that, partly because the electronic versions of these articles were not compiled. They were individually searchable. So in that case, actually, the New York Times had to go back and negotiate with their individual contractors from the past. Whether this is good or not, it really depends on your perspective and depends on the individual situation. One of the really negative outcomes of the Ticini case for libraries was that there was content that we had paid for in our news databases that had to be removed from the databases because the people who had put it in didn't have the rights to do so. There were articles that went missing from the online copies of those news publications that have never come back because they couldn't go back and get the rights. That's a pretty negative outcome. In this case with the Julia of the Wolves book, it sounds like there could be a negative outcome. Julia of the Wolves is a classic piece of children's literature. It's not one I've actually read recently, but the librarian in me goes, ooh, I know that book. If the result of this is that the ebook is no longer available because HarperCollins hasn't gotten around to it and this other company that was going to make it available doesn't have the right to do so, that's too bad. I mean, I'm always up for more content in more forms available to more people. So really, I think it depends a lot on the individual situation, what the outcomes of these are, but it really highlights the need both from the side of people acquiring content and from the side of individual authors to really see what's in those contracts and to think ahead about what the long-term implications might be.
Right. And that is Franklin's message of this point. He says the language in the contract is what caught my eye and provides an important lesson in contract drafting. Think ahead. So we'll make think ahead our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you're listening to the show for either continuing legal education credit or other professional credit, we've got some information for you over on the TWIT Wiki at wiki.twit.tv under the This Week in Law page there. You can find everything you need to know about doing that. Evan, do you think it would have made a difference if the contract, really in 1971, it's pretty amazing that it did say that it could be published in book form and electronic means now known or hereinafter invented. What if it just said means, not electronic? Do you think it would, that would have altered the outcome at all?
Well, it may have made the court's decision a little more difficult because right away they were able to focus on whether or not ebooks, and we all know that the E in ebook stands for electronic, right? Unless I missed something. You know, it made their analysis on that point quite easier. They were able to focus that right together. But I'm not so sure it would have made a difference if it just said that you've got the right to publish it in book form and in all other means now known or later developed. And guess where I got that language? Now known or later developed. That comes right out of Section 102 of the Copyright Act in the provision that talks about those things in which copyright protection will subsist. Now, granted, 1971 was before 1976 when this was enacted, but I know that they were drafting, that the process of drafting the 76 Act started way back in the 60s. So it's safe to assume that this whole concept of forward-looking rights was at least in the air at that point, whether it had started to become codified in what was to become the 76 Act. I don't know. I could travel back in time and see, maybe read some legislative intent and some congressional record on all that. But with all that said, I mean, yeah, that really was forward-thinking on the part of the lawyers representing the parties, probably the lawyers representing HarperCollins or Harper & Row, whichever one it was that got those rights to Julie and the Wolves in 1971. Because, yeah, that's like, you know, that was only 2 years after Al Gore had invented the internet. And so this was really early in the, in the whole idea of content communications, not just data being transmitted by electronic means. So, and as an aside, isn't it great to see Franklin blogging like he is? That was a great post.
It is.
Good.
Yes, and I'm going to have to check with him and see if he knows more about the lawyers who drafted this HarperCollins contract and dig deeper, because we may just have found evidence of time travelers if they were able to be that forward-looking in 1971.
Right.
All right, well, I don't know if George W. Bush has done any time traveling, although he is a Renaissance man these days and has been pursuing a lot of painting in his post-presidential years. And like Shepard Fairey, we're wondering if he may well become a poster child for fair use, because it has been revealed, somebody doing a little digging discovered, and I'm not sure if it is this Animal New York site that turned this up. That's where I first saw it. AnimalNewYork.com did a little Googling of images of the people that Bush has made paintings of and now on display at his presidential library, and discovered that oftentimes the very first Google image result for someone such as, say, Vladimir Putin, would be the image that George Bush chose to model his painting after. So much like Shepard Fairey and the famous iconic image of President Obama, It seems that George Bush, you know, was using often news photographs to as the creative muse for his paintings. So we are left with the question of whether there's a copyright issue here, and perhaps George Bush becoming the champion of fair use. What do you think, Nancy?
Well, I've had, unsurprisingly, I have friends who talk about this stuff on social media, and some of them are lawyers and some of them are artists, which has led to some really hilarious conversations in the last couple of days. One of my artist friends has sort of suggested that these are not, basically, it's like these are not worth defending because George Bush is a jerk. Another artist friend said these are not worth defending because they're terrible paintings. But the copyright lawyers tend to weigh towards the, well, these are an interesting copyright problem. I think it's worth pointing out that these are actually two interesting copyright problems. The copyright question of can George Bush as an individual make paintings based on news photos is kind of a, you know, it's a fair use question that to me feels pretty obvious. Yeah, I can make paintings based on news photos. Can I go to an art gallery and as a student sit in front of paintings and copy them? Yeah, that seems to be something we expect people to be able to do. You know, how much you transform it or not doesn't even usually come up in the question of things like students going to galleries and copying from that. It's actually an established technique of learning to paint. Is either to follow the techniques of established painters and copy their techniques, or to work from, you know, established images and work on your photorealism. So I don't know that can he make the paintings is a particularly challenging question, but we've got a different question here, which is, can he do a display of these paintings? You know, these paintings are in a gallery show. And I think that's a much more complicated question because it's a gallery show. Are they acknowledging the AP photos as sources? Are all of the photo sources AP photos? That's another question. I don't think, given the way people have been talking about, oh, he copied from news images, I don't think the gallery show is giving any credit to the originating photos. Credit's not directly a copyright issue most of the time, but it certainly sort of affects how much of a jerk you look like if you ever get sued about copyright. that's how I often talk about it with people when they're excited about credit and fair use issues. So they're not giving credit to the original photos. There's another way that credit does sort of affect copyright. First of all, should they have to pay for a license for their display of the derivative works? That's maybe one fair use question. But then there's also the fact that they are commercially benefiting, somebody's benefiting in some way from this display. I don't know if George Bush is himself, but somebody who's putting on the display is either getting economic or just attention benefits. And they are not passing on the benefits of that attention to people who are visiting their display. So, you know, if you wanted to make an argument that this is causing market harm, right, they're using my image for commercial purposes, or perhaps not commercial. I don't know the details of the display, but they are using my image for a public display in a way that prevents people from finding my original and paying me for my original. So there's a couple of different ways you could make an argument about market harm for the display. Then, of course, there's for the display, you know, there's still the question, well, are these transformative uses? And transformative use tends to lean towards even commercial uses may be okay if they're transformative. And there, I don't, you know, that's where we get back to my artist friends going, but they're so bad. And other people saying, are they transformative because they're bad? Is that, like, you know, there have been other cases like this. There's lots of art based on photos, some licensed, some not. It's a kind of a challenging area. Like you can make transformative arguments. But sometimes you're thinking, well, there's also kind of not always fair to the photographer who's not even getting the attention that they might get if they got credit.
Okay, just to add some detail to the commercial aspect of the display, these are being exhibited at the George W. Bush Presidential Center in Dallas. One can purchase tickets to go see them, so it's not, you know, free to the public. One can also purchase the exhibit booklet, online or in person. So there definitely is revenue coming into the George W. Bush Presidential Center over the display of these paintings. Evan, what's your take?
Well, Condoleezza Rice told me that George W. had Donald Rumsfeld negotiate a license for all these, so it's no big deal. So we're all good. No issues here. Now, everything that Nancy said, I mean, I think that's a really good analysis of some of the different issues that play into this, especially with the market effect and all of that stuff. Where I see some interesting commentary and analysis to be had is on that question of the transformative nature of all of this. And this sort of picks up on a thread that Marty Schwimmer was talking about last week, more in the trademark and kind of on that boundary area where you can sort of straddle copyright and trademark issues when it comes to parodies and fair use when it comes to that. I was immediately, I mean, of course, I thought about the Shepard Fairey case, and I think Shepard Fairey had a much better fair use argument than what George W. does in this one here, because at least in that case, he had changed the color and made it appear different, and it sort of conveyed a message that the original photograph did not. Here, we've just got sort of slavish copying of the photograph in the best way that a new artist like the former president can do. He was trying his best. So, but then I also thought about a case from more than 20 years ago out of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals called Rogers versus Coons. And this is a case that anyone taking a copyright class in law school, you get to know this case. And Victor, in the show notes, this is what we were talking right before we started. I put a link in the spreadsheet to an image of the subject matter in Rogers versus Coons. So there you go here. So on the right is the, on the left is a photograph. And this was a photograph that the plaintiff Rogers took, and that they used this on greeting cards and postcards and stuff like that. And on the right is a sculptural work by Jeffrey Koons, a pretty well-known artist. And he was able to fetch almost $400,000 from selling three copies of this sculptural work that you see that he made over here on the right. That was clearly a copy of the photograph that you see on the left. And for those of you just listening to the audio, this photo is not hard to find online if you search for Rogers versus Coons.
It's a Coons, couple sitting on a bench with a bunch of dogs.
That's right. And puppies. So Coons wanted to make a commentary on the banality of everyday life, and he instructed his assistants who, did the work. I think this is a wooden sculpture painted, so it's multimedia. He instructed them to copy as closely as possible the photograph. And, they did a reasonably good job, better than I could do with a pocket knife or Swiss Army. So, and then, just a couple of differences. The puppies are blue. The photograph is black and white, so maybe those puppies actually were blue in real life. I don't know. Probably not. But so they made the puppies in blue, exaggerated their noses, and put flowers in the hair of the people. And the photographer sued Jeffrey Koons over this. And long story short, Jeffrey Koons lost. He had argued that this was a parody commenting on the subject matter of, the banality of everyday American life. And the court didn't buy that because it wasn't too much of a commentary on the work itself. So, now we can switch back over to the George Bush painting scenario. I don't see any sort of commentary. I don't see this as even being nearly as close of a case as what Shepard Fairey had or what Jeffrey Koons had, who lost. There's not nearly as much commentary going on here, which would fall under that analysis of the transformative effect, which, of course, is only one of the non-exhaustive fair use factors. I just don't see it at all here where there's any transformative thing going on here, unless you could somehow say that, this is the perspective of world leaders through a former world leader himself who got to know them. But man, you're just really getting out there on the periphery of how this could be viewed as commentary. So I think that a fair use argument is pretty, would be pretty thin in something like this based on some of the things we've seen already, particularly if a court were to follow the line from that the Coons case, which of course has the factual touch point to this one of being a subsequent work that's based on a photograph. So George W. I'm sure you'll figure out something if put called to the mat here, but hopefully this will probably just stay academic, you know, our discussion of this.
Yes. Good law school exam question, this one. All right. I think there's something really interesting that has come to light about Dropbox, and Kyle Orland wrote about it over at Ars Technica. And it not only implicates copyright issues, but it illustrates how in the era of stringent copyright enforcement in which we live, that copyright issues can also begin to raise, I would call them, privacy issues. Although we can discuss in a moment the, you know, whether if you are sharing something that infringes, you have any sort of privacy interest. You know, typically when you're doing something that violates the law, any other rights that you might have in pursuing that activity would go away. But here what we're talking about is for files being publicly shared on Dropbox. What happened here is someone named Daryl Whitelaw tweeted a picture of an error he received when he tried to share a Dropbox file via IM. And what happened was he got this error message immediately after publicly sharing the file, which caused him to think, well, gee, I'm getting the file that I publicly shared is getting automatically and immediately scrutinized for copyright issues, because what the Dropbox page warned was that files in his folder might be subject to a DMCA takedown notice. So what developed here, and there's some nice journalism that Kyle did to really flesh out the details of the story, is it turns out that Dropbox is keeping records, data on files that it has removed for pursuant to DMCA notices. So it has hashes of those files. And if something that you share matches one of those hashes, then apparently, this seems to be what happened to Daryl Whitelaw, it's going to, before there's even a DMCA notice filed as to the specific thing that you shared, it's going to match it to your hash and proactively say that it can't be shared. So this seems to be what Dropbox is doing in order to take care of its copyright compliance issues. Now, understandably, this has people concerned, because people put all manner of things and share all manner of things via Dropbox. And I guess a law-abiding, non-infringing person might be concerned that the moment that something is shared with another user of the service, that a scrutiny of that file is being done, and there could be some privacy concerns to be talked about there. So, Nancy, I wonder what you think about all this.
There's a quote in the article that says, "I think of Dropbox as my hard drive." And I'm sort of, there's a part of me that goes, why on earth would you think of Dropbox as your hard drive? It's networked. It's networked and it enables public sharing. There's also part of me that's really sympathetic to this, because while I actually don't use Dropbox, partly for those reasons that I know it's not actually mine, private space, you know, it's a super convenient tool for people who are on the go. Having files that are networked is really important to being able to, you know, travel around and do different things. So, you know, I have sympathy, but I'm a little bit surprised people who, you know, I'm not surprised if you haven't been paying attention at all. I'm a little bit surprised if you've been paying attention to content issues online for a while, and you are surprised that online hosting services are running hashes against your files. It's not, they're actually not required by the DMCA to police their content that way. There's been kind of a lot of fighting in the aggrieved portions of the content industry who talk about how the DMCA takedown process doesn't ever work, that there should be a notice and stay down requirement, not just a notice and takedown requirement, because the takedown requirement lets everybody just, it's like playing whack-a-mole because everybody just re-uploads the file. Okay. That is a problem, actually. It's really a problem for people who are like independent content providers. It's not a big problem for massive corporations, because they have these business relationships with a lot of the online hosts where, through the business connections that they have, they're getting hosts to implement proactive policing technologies. Most of that's through private arrangements. There have been a few cases here and there where courts have been a little bit more, the DMCA 512 service provider liability provisions that give you sort of isolation from liability for hosting people's stuff. There's been some back and forth on whether those impose a duty to police files. As read and in the initial interpretations, they impose neither a duty to police nor liability if you do police, like that they're actually supposed to encourage either one of those paths. A few courts have read in some duties to police, some related to knowing what's on your server. But most of these hashes and like the YouTube content ID system really are more on the sort of private ordering side of things. It's just that they've been a growing part of the private ordering side of online content hosting for quite a while. It's an interesting thing that affects me in my daily work in a very odd way, which is I deliver workshops about copyright online. And in my workshops about copyright, I often use copyrighted content to illustrate things related, especially to specific cases. My institution has until recently, well, actually currently still does, host some online conferencing services for us. But we've also signed up with Google for Google Apps. I see a day coming when I'll be encouraged to use Google Hangouts for all my workshops. I love the technology of Google Hangouts. I know YouTube Content ID is run on Hangouts. I can just see coming down the pike sometime when I'm teaching a copyright workshop and my workshop gets cut off because the algorithm matches my content against content ID hashes. And even though my use is fair use, the algorithm can't recognize that kind of stuff.
Just don't use Grand Theft Auto in any of your presentations. It harkens back to what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. There was like, what was it, Denise? It was like a record label, like a jazz artist, right? Heard the sirens.
Yes.
And a screen, you know, a video cast from Grand Theft Auto and took it down.
There's right. Also some.
It also harkens back to Professor Lessig and his presentation where he used the, what's it called? Listomania.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Australian artist. So, yeah, absolutely. I think you're
French.
Right, Nancy. That
the record label is Australian, but Phoenix is French.
Yeah. Gotcha.
I don't know why that I had to stress that point, but it just, you know, go ahead.
En français, s'il vous plaît. I think you're absolutely right that as more and more people start adopting Google Hangouts, that you're going to see that problem, especially in the academic arena where fair use is a necessary part of getting your point across. The other really interesting thing I thought reading through this is the discussion here about not only is Dropbox keeping hashes of things that have been subject to DMCA takedowns, but it has been using file hashing algorithms, it says, for a while now as a means of deduplicating identical files stored across different users' accounts. That means that if I try to upload an identical copy of a 20 gigabyte movie file that has already been stored in someone else's Dropbox account, the service will simply give my account access to a version of that same file rather than allowing me to upload an identical version. This not only saves bandwidth on the user's end, but significant storage space on Dropbox's end as well. And of course, it makes perfect sense from an efficiency and bandwidth standpoint to do it that way. But from a legal standpoint, that's pretty problematic. That's what put MP3 Tunes out of business years ago. And this is file lockering and enabling people to use a server-based copy potentially across many, many users. Does this set off your copyright red flags, Evan?
Yes. I mean, there's obviously the privacy issues of it. And I think those are pretty self-evident. You know, like, wait, what if, you know, I uploaded this file in Dropbox, you're going to allow somebody access this file that I think I've uploaded myself. And, you know, what if there's some error in the hash matching, and instead of this file that the other user thinks he's going to see home videos that I didn't want anyone else to see, for example, or something like that. So, you know, there's that. And then I could also just imagine, let's take this a year out, where we have a decision from the Supreme Court in Aereo, and the Supreme Court comes down on Aereo's side and says, it's all right. It doesn't, how do we articulate this? You know, it's all right. The transmit clause allows you to do this because it's one copy, one person, one user, what have you there. I could just imagine Aereo and its lawyers saying, Dropbox, look at all this work we did for you going to the Supreme Court to validate this business model. And here you go doing stuff like this where it's one copy, multiple users. We blazed this path for you and you have to go mess it up. And even though we saved the cloud, you Dropbox go and mess it up like you done. So, you know, there's that whole side of it too. I see that as an interesting copyright, you know, more like, you know, going 18 months into the future, looking back, but, you know, maybe we can look back at this and say we were prescient or something.
So, Nancy, what do you think about the one copy, multiple users issue for Dropbox?
Yeah, I was thinking pretty much exactly the same way about the Aereo comparisons and the MP3 tunes. You know, this issue of like who has to make how many copies, when are you like doing something like digital first sale? Do you have to erase the one that's already on your hard drive when you share it with someone else? This is an area where there, like, the law is so completely out of touch with the technology that it results in these absolutely bonkers things that, you know, I think it totally makes sense to hash against your storage, you know, for minimizing storage. It totally makes sense to say, we only store one copy of that file, you know, and we share it off to everybody. But copyright-wise, I mean, the courts have been pretty consistent in saying sharing out one file to everybody is much more of a problem than sharing out the file to the person who uploaded it and sending it back to that one person. You know, that's counterintuitive, but oh my God, you know, copyright's counterintuitive in a lot of different ways. So I think this is a really interesting example of, like, you know, they're doing this one thing for copyright compliance where they're like, if it was DMCA notified, we're not going to let you share it with people. At the same time, they're applying the same technology in a way that may actually expose them to some liability in the future.
Yeah. It's almost one of those only rare instances where being old is an assistance to you in having an online business or, you know, some sort of forward-looking dot-com startup that, you know, I think the people at Dropbox just weren't around when mp3.com got shut down and don't remember that it resulted in the then largest damages award I think ever awarded.
It's like $70 trillion or something.
It, right? It was a lot of money. I don't remember what it was. But at the time, I just remember it was like, you know, never before have we had.
Probably more than Michael Robertson had in his bank account at that moment.
Definitely that, yes. Yeah. All right. Well, since we're already talking about some entertainment-related issues and have touched on Aereo, let's actually play our bumper and go there.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right. I just wanted to see if anyone has any current thoughts about Aereo. I put an interesting article in our rundown, and folks can access everything we've been discussing that has inspired our discussions on the show today at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/254. A good piece by Matt Schreurs called Cloud Denialism Precedes the Aereo Case. The Aereo case is about to be argued in the Supreme Court within a couple of weeks here before the end of April. And there has been, as this article points out, some seeding of the environment from the entertainment industry side of things, trying to point out the disasters that will befall if the Aereo case goes the way that Aereo wants it to, and how cloud computing is not truly on the block here, so Hollywood wants us to think. So Nancy, do you have a take on this?
I don't. I haven't been following Aereo quite as closely as some other cases because it's not quite as directly tied to my work. But I've been really interested in this question about like the cloud computing threat here is related to the fact that the files are being streamed back. And it's sort of conflating a couple of different things that traditionally have been different things in copyright. Like cloud computing isn't actually anything new. It kind of makes me annoyed when people are like, ooh, cloud computing is a new thing. I'm like, it's just servers, you know. But and servers and clients have been around for a little while, most of my life. So when you're using a server in a more sort of traditional way, when you put a file on it and you take the file back off of it, there's no real argument that could be made about public performances there. You're making copies. There's not a public element to the transmission. But somehow streaming has brought in this idea that even if you're streaming to an individual or multiple individuals across multiple different streaming accounts, that's a performance. So I'm really, really interested in the way that actually streaming technologies are playing into this. Obviously, you know, we don't want to undercut streaming content from the cloud. And I really do think that the way the case is being argued, there could definitely be precedent coming out of it that would make cloud streaming services way harder to do legally.
Evan, what do you think?
Yeah, I buy into that. I mean, you know that if the decision in Aereo comes out that way, then the stakeholders who would benefit from its broadest possible interpretation will indeed make the argument that it could. So it almost seems like one way or the other, there's going to be a legislative fix that would need to come about from this to match up the legal framework for all of this, you know, to match up that the legal framework and the modern technological reality. If cloud computing is killed, then maybe Congress would step in and say something appropriate to amend the transmit clause if the Aereo business model is validated, and that means the end of over-the-air television. Maybe, you know, even though this might not be what we would want to see, maybe there will be some sort of framework, some compulsory licensing framework put in, something to you know, keep that, you know, to keep that from dying off by being killed by the validation of Aereo as an acceptable, non-infringing means of the distribution of content. So, you know, I've said it before, I think Aereo is pretty watershed, and something's going to happen one way or the other that we're going to look back at the Aereo decision. And, you know, I think it'll make the hall of fame of copyright cases, you know, with the things that we spend a lot of time talking about, cases like Grokster, Sony. You know, if we get back into the old days of, I think was it just last week or fairly recently, talking about Baker versus Selden and Cerrone, you know, some of the, you know, the Hall of Fame of copyright cases. I think Aereo has the potential of being up there if the court truly decides to take the issues on and not do something strange procedurally with it.
Yeah. All right. So we're still waiting on that one. A couple of weeks ago, when Popcorn Time was much in the news, Farhad Manju published an article that is primarily about windowing. He titled it "Why Movie Streaming Sites So Fail to Satisfy." It's in the New York Times. He highlights the fact that Netflix Instant thinking about adding good movie was an Onion headline recently. So, you know, running joke that the online streaming services are doing the best they can with what they have to work with in going through proper channels to license everything. But something like Popcorn Time comes along when, you know, people can get what they want when they want it. And that's why it seems so compelling. So the message of his article basically is Hollywood's going to have to rethink this whole windowing thing if they expect to compete with piracy and free. But there doesn't seem to be much movement toward that. I would say that the one thing I've seen recently is there seems to be a move toward putting movies, say, on Amazon Instant on the day that they have their DVD release, but they have the DVD price. In other words, you can't rent them until the window expires and they're available for rental. So people are still being held hostage for the $15 or $20 that they need to pay to get the DVD or the HD quality streaming right when the movie is released on DVD, which do people still buy DVDs? I'm not sure. So I thought it would be interesting to just talk about what you guys think about the future of windowing, whether we will be living with it for much longer or not. And Nancy, you were telling us before the show, you were just at a conference where this issue came up.
Yeah. Oh, on a side note, I actually still buy DVDs because I like to actually have physical content that doesn't have license restrictions on it. But I don't know how long I'm going to be able to keep doing that. I don't know how long physical DVDs are going to continue to be available. I was at a conference last week at Berkeley where we were talking about legislative copyright reform. And there were a lot of different conversations. There were a lot of really different points of view represented in the room, which is one of the things I love about this conference. And at one point, one of the people from the music industry, from the movie industry, who was there, you know, they were talking about a different issue, and then said, "But we couldn't fix that because then windowing wouldn't work." As if windowing was this sort of set thing that had. I think it was completely not on his radar that windowing is a created thing. It's a way that the movie industry business model has worked, but the way he talked about it, and you know, this may have been intentional, but it may actually be just sort of so ingrained in his mind. Windowing has to happen, so we can't do these other things. I was at a table with a bunch of librarians, and there were a lot of other people who represent public interest groups related to copyright, and a lot of scholars in the room who have a fairly nuanced view of copyright. And there were a lot of small noises around the room as he's said, well, windowing must exist because, you know, windowing doesn't have to exist. It's something that the movie industry cooked up to allow them to charge different prices in different markets. So, you know, they release in movie theaters. They don't release in DVD on the same day. They release in movie theaters in the U.S. and then the poor people in other parts of the world are having to wait for 6 months before the movie is released there so that they can price differentiate. There's, you know, very related concept is the region encoding on DVDs. That's a way of separating markets so that you can price discriminate. Well, I mean, movie industry managed to make region encoding not just an industry standard, but to make it actually a violation of the law to circumvent region encoding. I mean, that's one of the things in the DMCA that sort of you bought a DM, you know, your DVD playing software will maybe let you switch regions a couple of times, but not after a long time. And it's really hard to buy hardware that can legally play multiple region DVDs. So while I think that windowing is something that is actually probably encouraging piracy in a lot of markets, you know, if you know the movie exists, why would you wait 6 months until it's in a theater in your market? Like, I do think windowing is probably encouraging piracy. But at the same time, like, if we think that the movie industry is just going to give up on this model, they haven't in the past, and they have managed to make legislative changes that require technologies to enforce some of the business model business model decisions that they have made and are trying to stick to, even though they may be out of date.
Evan, do you think that tools like Popcorn Time, you know, if not Popcorn Time itself, other tools that come along and make torrenting simple for the masses and maybe comforting for the masses, thinking that perhaps they're more insulated in some way, even if they are not, from direct liability for infringement. Do you think that will have an impact on windowing?
Well, you know, it would almost have to. And if it's sort of like, it, you know, the same analysis that would go into a government's thought process as to whether to change some policy because of outrageous, or outrageous isn't the right word, but very strong, very vocal, very widespread civil disobedience. From a market standpoint, eventually the content industry ought to fashion itself so that it's meeting the demand. And what better way to perceive that demand than through activities like widespread adoption in the consumer base of technologies like Popcorn Time, and I'm sure we'll see many others of its ilk come into existence here in the near future. I think the best similarity we can point to is the way that music piracy changed. I don't really know if music piracy changed, but certainly the manner and means and the economic circumstances of the consumption of digital music files changed with iTunes. That was a huge shift there. We ought to expect something similar if the content industry is going to see the demand through this way. At the same time, I think we need to be a little bit careful in critiquing the content industry's model on this. And I know this is what people love hearing me say. Is, you know, I mean, there is a certain real economic benefit to them creating scarcity in this way of the commodities that they distribute. And I'm sure we don't have to go too far afield to see industries creating scarcity themselves when it comes to the distribution of other goods that don't necessarily is directly involved intellectual property. You know, like companies will have seasonal promotions all the time. And, you know, that's a certain kind of scarcity. Same question is, why can't I get Girl Scout cookies in September? You know, I love Girl Scout cookies. I'm entitled to them. But you know what? The Girl Scouts only sell them in the, you know, late winter or whenever that is. You know, I know that we're out of our supply, so I'm jonesing for Girl Scout cookies. But so, you know, I mean, you can think of all these kinds of different examples. And so we've got to be cautious before we just say that it's a priori a bad thing for a market to be able to fashion its distribution modes in ways that foster scarcity. So that's just got to play into the analysis somehow.
If I may, go ahead.
Yeah, there's another benefit from price discrimination that is very real and very much worldwide. The ability to window means that they can charge different prices in different parts of the world. If the movie industry is forced by technological developments into releasing movies sort of once, whose price is going to set that? You know, what region is going to set the price for that? The region that can pay the highest. So they'll set a price that U.S. consumers can pay. And consumers in other parts of the world, or less economically advantaged consumers in this part of the world, won't be able to buy the one price, one purchase copy. This is something we think about in the library world because we really are one of the places that is the only way that certain people can access technology, even in our relatively rich economy in the U.S.
Is that necessarily true, Nancy, though? Because couldn't they release at different prices just at the same time?
Well, there will be a lot of questions about what kinds of discrimination can be and can't be supported. Right now, the reason windowing happens really is about price discrimination. There's some degree to which they would be able to offer sales in different countries at different prices. But if you really want to combat piracy, you want to try to get it out there at the best price point for the places where you do the least work to segment your market. Sorry, I don't know if that made the most sense. But I think they probably could price discriminate to some extent, but I do think the possibility of much lower priced copies for certain markets is a lot harder to achieve if you are not windowing, if you are not region encoding.
Right, and the only way for the message to get sent is for that, you know, high priced market to vote with its wallet, and if they're not going to buy into windowing, if they're going to be able to wait it out until something is available at a lower price. I'm sure that many people do that being a woman of principles, I would have liked to do it with the second installment of The Hobbit, but Benedict Cumberbatch just did me in. You know, I couldn't wait. I didn't get to see it in the theater and when it came out on Amazon and was available for $15, I plunked it down. So, you know. There go my principles. I think since we're talking about movies, this would be a good time for an intermission and a snack because we have a new sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and it is NatureBox, and I'm really excited about it. They sent me a box, and for those who have listened to the show a lot and picked up various aspects of the way we run our household, you know that I enjoy, in fact, could not survive without having certain necessities of life delivered to the house. I'm not one to go spend a lot of time at Costco or the supermarket. So this is a great thing for people who, like me, love to have healthy snacks around. You know, I've got a little kid running around, and am I going to always have the Twinkies there for him, or am I going to have something that's tasty and healthy? Well, I'd much rather have the latter. And that's a wonderful perk of NatureBox. It's easy to talk tough about eating right, but when you're starving at 3 p.m. all cranky and lightheaded, the evil vending machine can seem like your only friend. And of course, you don't want to resort to the evil vending machine. There it is. It's got teeth. It's going to grab you because it's got some nasty stuff in there. You don't have to give in, though. You can keep your eye on looking and feeling great and head over to naturebox.com/twit. If you click on the continue button there, you'll have three different subscription options. Then you can place your order. Once you're a member, you can select which snacks you'd like in your monthly box. You can select by your dietary needs. There's vegan, soy, gluten-free, lactose-free, nut-free, non-GMO. You can also select by taste, savory, sweet, or spicy. It sends great tasting snacks right to your door with free shipping anywhere in the U.S. We're talking healthy and satisfying snacks like barbecue kettle kernels, French toast granola, chili lime pistachios, and over 100 more, all with zero trans fat, zero high fructose corn syrup, and nothing artificial. NatureBox is the snack happy gift that keeps on giving. You can order a 3 or 6 or 12 month subscription for a special someone, a family or friend. Wonderful way to give a gift. And don't forget, swimsuit weather is almost here. It's time to start snacking smarter. Forget that evil vending machine. Get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like honey mesquite almonds. So go ahead and sign up for this. You won't regret it. You can get half off your first box by going to naturebox.com/twit. Stay full, stay strong, and go to naturebox.com/twit. Thank you so much, NatureBox, for your support of This Week in Law.
They sent me one, too, and it really is awesome. Our six-year-old is like the pickiest eater on the face of the planet, and he loved the whole wheat raspberry fig bar. So I'm just jumping in here, really.
Absolutely.
We're totally ordering this. It's good stuff.
You must have gotten sweet. I think I got savory because we had more nuts and spicy things, but they're all delicious.
Yeah, for sure.
So check them out, naturebox.com/twit. All right. We cannot end this show without talking about some of the privacy developments that happened this week. So let's go there. So the scary thing about Heartbleed, hopefully you've heard about Heartbleed. If you haven't, you like me, have been burying yourself under a rock and on spring break. But even I've heard about it. So Heartbleed apparently is a problem with OpenSSL. And what I'm gleaning about it is it's so terribly frightening because sites can't have been compromised, and they never will have known about it. The compromise happens through a layer that just can't even be tracked. Certain sites have been compromised: Yahoo, Imgur, Flickr, various others. HideMyAss.com is probably one of my favorites to just talk about. But in any event, it's a security hole that's capable of being exploited. There's no way of knowing how much it has been exploited. Your password and other information can be out there. Sites are being very proactive in letting you know whether or not they've been compromised or not, or they think they are capable of having been compromised. You know, the Gizmodo piece wraps up by saying, you can also put on a tinfoil hat, but sometimes the best solution is just to keep a close eye on your credit card statement. This one is so deeply tied into the way that secure data is sent over the web that, again, there's really no way for sites to know what kind of leakage has happened. So it's a big deal, and I know that you've been paying attention to it too, Nancy. Any thoughts or takeaways on this particular security breach? It doesn't seem to have been an exploit of any kind that someone consciously did. It was just a coding error.
Yeah, I have one thought from the copyright and computer geek side of things, you know. I am a huge fan of open source solutions to all kinds of different problems. And a couple of people have said, well, this is highlighting the weaknesses of open source in correcting itself. Other people have said, well, no, I mean, open source is actually really good at correcting itself. It's kind of surprising that something this big has gotten through. But, you know, the amount of coding that's done in open source communities, this kind of error has occurred before and has gotten caught before. So, you know, there's been a little bit of like discrediting open source because of this. And I don't, you know, I'm definitely not on board with that. I do think it's a good argument for investing more in support of open source, you know, get more people looking at that stuff and the more likely you are to catch these things sooner. Another perspective from which I've been thinking about this, because I'm known by my librarian friends as being a paranoid person. I think I'm not at all paranoid because I hang out with people who, you know, hack computers for a living. So I don't use the same password anywhere. And apparently this is an unusual practice, which upsets me. But a lot of my friends have been talking about using password managers. So there's been a lot of discussion about how you can avoid problems from things like this, either by generating different passwords for every site you go to or using a password manager to do that. At least one of the most popular password management tools was compromised or was open to exploit under this bug. But so that's been an interesting point of discussion. I always like the XKCD comic about password strength from a couple of years ago. So just the idea that there's ways of making yourself less vulnerable to these kinds of bugs when they come up in the future, but they're not things that everybody knows about. So I was like making people more aware of that.
Good point. Evan, are you going around changing passwords or adopting a password manager? And do you think that, I mean, this has got to be frustrating for law enforcement because there's no paper trail here.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you haven't heard much about tracing down or, you know, actually investigating some of the fallout from this, any responsible parties. So yeah, that has to be frustrating. Yeah, I was sort of freaking out because, you know, I had to go and change my credentials at my Us Magazine subscription, you know, so I was that was the first thing I did when I heard about this. When I tried to figure out what was going on or try to understand sort of from a technical standpoint what is actually going on here, you know, I see what it's all about. It looks like it could be bad. I guess the assumption is that a lot of credentials are out there, and you know, orders of millions and millions of, you know, of information that people wouldn't want out there is out there. It really sort of came into perspective when you read Bruce Schneier. You know, he's sort of the, in my book, and I think for many others, the be-all and end-all on, you know, statements about security and how to think about these issues. And he says that on a scale of 1 to 10, this problem is an 11. So I take that at face value that it's pretty bad, even not necessarily being to point to particular reasons why not or why it is bad. But he did make an interesting addition to his blog post on it yesterday. And, you know, so far, you know, Heartbleed's been out for a while, right? More than a week. And, you know, we don't see any evidence of anything truly catastrophic having happened yet. He comments of whether there's going to be some backlash from the mainstream press and the public if nothing bad happens. Isn't that kind of like no good deed goes unpunished? You know, comparing it to something like the Y2K bug, you know, is this going to be something where the security industry is going to be, you know, accused of crying wolf? So sort of a strange proposition because, you know, if proactive measures are being taken right away to prevent any fallout, you know, it's sort of like the problem is solved. And that's why there's no backlash. You know, the same thing happened with Y2K. Companies spent billions of dollars preparing for the turn of the century, and the disasters that we were all concerned about did not happen. And, you know, get accused of crying wolf. But like, wait, you know, you wanted something bad to happen? Would that have made, you know, would that have been better? Certainly not as sensational for the reporting on this kind of stuff. So I see that meta phenomenon of, you know, the reaction to this as something pretty interesting that'll be neat to watch and see, you know, because I'm optimistic nothing bad is going to happen just because it's better to be optimistic in that way. So we should watch for this accusation of crying wolf phenomenon. I think that's pretty interesting.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we generally expect that people exploiting technological weaknesses to be black hat hackers, someone that law enforcement would be coming after if they could. This week there was a story that shows us that even law enforcement will take advantage of vulnerabilities that they discover. It came to light that some Los Angeles police officers were sabotaging their own voice recorders. These are the recorders that are automatically activated both in the car and on an officer's person when they are in the process of engaging with somebody. And these actually are protective measures oftentimes for the police in case of a passerby or someone they're actually engaging with making their own recording. The police can have their version to show, you know, what they think happened or say happened. But some officers apparently didn't like being surveilled in this way so much, and they figured out that if they removed the antennas from the recorders, that this seriously degraded its ability to pick up what was going on. And so some antennas were removed, and there was an internal investigation, and it's just coming to light now. I think that there was a lot left to be desired in how this whole thing was handled. But it's not always the hacker exploiting the technological vulnerability. Apparently, the police will do it, too, if they figure out that they can. This is more just kind of a sad comment on society and a bit of comic relief for the show. Evan, do you have anything to add?
Well, can you blame them? I mean, geez, would you want a recording to be made of everything that you're doing in the course of your work during the course of the day? So, you know, you can kind of see where the cops are coming from. They're human. You know, they shouldn't be doing this because part of the reason that this technology is there is to protect them and their perspective. You know, somebody's going to say that they were the subject of brutality at the hands of the police. This video evidence could be disculpatory, right? Or wait, exculpatory. What's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, exculpatory.
Yes, exculpatory.
Yeah, whatever. And so exactly. Maybe that's just why we just need to have robots replace all law enforcement. So have robots going out there policing everyone. That'll solve it.
Yes, because if they're following the three laws of robotics, apparently they would not remove their antennas. Right. Any thoughts on this, Nancy?
I'm not so perhaps convinced of the police always having the best motivations, as you seem maybe to be. I'm not surprised at all that police officers removed their antennas. I'm not so worried about them needing the exculpatory evidence as the fact that I suspect that some of them removed the antennas because they intended to do things they knew they didn't want caught on tape. I really have a lot of respect for law enforcement, but I have seen far too much abuse of power to expect that the law enforcement always has the best of intentions on any technological developments.
Okay, and on the NSA surveillance front, just a quick update on a case that we've discussed before. It is the only district court case in the United States where a judge has come out and said that the phone data gathering practices may violate the Fourth Amendment and do violate a reasonable expectation of privacy. It's called the Clayman versus Obama case. There was some effort by the lawyers there to launch that case directly from the D.C. District Court, where it was heard. Judge Leon was the district judge there, up to the Supreme Court. That, unsurprisingly, was not successful. What generally happens is there has to be an appellate-level review before you get to knock on the Supreme Court's door and ask them to hear your case. And that's what's going to happen in this Clayman case. The D.C. Circuit is going to get its crack at looking at these issues. Also on the NSA front, and speaking of windowing, Edward Snowden has given this exclusive interview to Vanity Fair, which seems distinctive in how much of it is known about it before, you know, its actual release, at least, you know, as the week has been wending on here. I think it may have been released. Today's the 11th, right? So I think it came out yesterday. And I think we'll probably talk about it more next week. Don't have too much that I wanted to delve into it about it. I mean, some interesting insights from Edward Snowden. Evan, I don't know if there's anything here you want to delve into, or maybe we should just shelve this one and move on to our tip and resource. What do you think?
Yeah, well, let's talk more about it in the future. I think the interesting thing I'm going to pay attention to when I'm actually reading it is the comparison that Snowden draws between himself and Julian Assange. You know, he says, unlike Assange, he himself, Snowden, is not anti-secrecy. He's just pro-accountability. So that's what I'm going to find interesting when reading the article is how Snowden thinks of himself in relation to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange.
Absolutely. So let's go on to our tip and resource of the week. Our tip of the week is also, you know, a current event, and that is that Newegg founder, in-house counsel Lee Chang is not someone you want to mess with. So if you are a patent troll, if you haven't already gotten the memo, and you go ahead and come after Lee Chang, who we've had on the show before, you're going to have to just take your lumps because he's going to be there to dish them out. The most current troll that he's made some headway with is called MacroSolve. They have managed to get $4.6 million in payments from over 63 defendants, but Geico and Newegg drew the line in the sand and said, if you're going to come after us, we're going to fight back. And in fact, they've formed a consortium of all the defendants in the MacroSolve cases just to make life more difficult for MacroSolve. And they've filed...
Is it true that Geico sent the little gecko? Because I have this image of that little gecko sitting on Lee Chang's shoulder going...
Yeah.
No trolling.
You know, geckos are well known for their ability to take down trolls. I don't know, you know, if you've come across that in your fantasy literature readings. Maybe Nancy has with her vast knowledge of the library contents. But yes, Geico the Gecko and Newegg have decided to stand up to MacroSolve. They filed an ex parte re-exam with the USPTO. Which prompted MacroSolve to withdraw all of its pending lawsuits. So that's a big deal. MacroSolve hasn't said it's going away. It's going to see what happens with the re-exam. It is blustering about potentially refiling. But it did go to Newegg some time ago and say, hey, you know, no harm, no foul, we'll go away. We're happy to dismiss you from this case. But Newegg said, not so fast, you know, we're not willing to waive our costs and fees. So if you're going to do this, don't think that you're going to get off scot-free. We're going to come after you for our costs and attorney's fees, as we are entitled to by law if we're the prevailing party in this suit. So don't mess with Lee Chang. Our resources of the week also relate partially to patents. There is a great piece by Derek Khanna over at Politics that is how to really fix the patent system and why Congress, unfortunately, is unlikely to do it. It's a great history of the patent system in the U.S. and a great delving deep into why we are where we are with the patent system and how it's not just patent trolls you need to be concerned about, but the large body of patents amassed by companies that you don't think of as trolls, the actual practicing entities, companies that have lots of technology, but just amass their patent portfolios really as a legal strategy more than anything else. So check out Derek's piece. Also, there's a great YouTube video. Maybe we could roll just a bit of it, Victor, called The Rise of the Patent Troll, that is terribly educational for anyone who you need. Starts with Adam Carolla there.
About to be dragged into a war over software.
I'm getting sued over software? Patents? I don't even know what software patents are.
Adam Carolla knows nothing about software and certainly has never patented any. But now, like many others, he finds himself trapped within the machinery of the American legal system. And all of this began with a simple but very powerful idea. An idea that would eventually spawn a monster.
So if you find yourself needing to know more about patent trolls or explain what they are, this is a really valuable resource. It and everything else that we're pointing to today will be at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/254. Also, courtesy of a guest who unfortunately couldn't join us this week, we hope to have Gabriella Coleman join us sometime soon. She is an expert on hackers and their ethics and ethos, and a scholar and author on those topics. She pointed to an SSL server test from Qualys SSL Labs that performs a deep analysis of the configuration of any SSL web server on the public internet to tell you whether it is vulnerable to the Heartbleed issue. So if you have not yet checked your server, I can't imagine that there is anyone who has not, or you are curious about a server that you may not be responsible for, but frequently use, you can check it here at Qualys SSL Labs. And with that, we're going to wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. Nancy, it's been such a pleasure having you join us. Tell us about anything that's going on in Minnesota or anything else that you think our listeners and viewers need to know about on your front.
I don't know that Minnesota itself is in a particularly good or bad place. We did have one Prenda case that has come up here, and there have been some weird developments with how that's proceeded procedurally. Oh, well, that was a very lawyerly thing to say. In the world of education and libraries and how we deal with copyright, there are a lot of really interesting and kind of pressing issues. There's been a lot of discussion in Congress lately about copyright reform, and the Copyright Office has also been inviting lots of commentary on things. And one of the topics that they've invited commentary on is this problem of orphan works. And I don't know if you're real familiar with that, but that's from the perspective of libraries, orphan works have a pretty specific definition. It's works for whom no author can be found, no rights holder can be found. And the most common situation where we're dealing with those is like archival materials. You know, the author died in 1974 and then their son inherited it and we don't know where the son went. And the son seems to have died in 1989 and who inherited it after that? There've been a lot of commentary on this. There was a proposed legislation a few years ago that failed because there's been a really, really negative response from independent photographers and illustrators, among others. And right now there's comments open from the Copyright Office on that topic. So we're looking to file on some of that. There's also been just like lots of different hearings about how to reform copyright and all the new ways to reform copyright. And at least from the library world perspective, and I know I'm not actually this limited in my perspective all the time, but we're a little worried about how that's going to go, because generally the voices that get heard the most on legislative issues are the ones with the largest wallets. And libraries and other public interest issues do not have very big wallets behind them. So if copyright reform is really something that's on the table, that's something that really lots of people should be thinking of as a public interest issue. I do take heart from the SOPA and PIPA protests. I think there are a lot of people who are more aware that copyright reform really could be something that affects individual people in their daily lives in negative ways. So I'm hoping that people are paying attention to that on sort of a democracy and public interest level.
It seems to me like more than ever they are, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep talking about it, because it definitely is important for people to keep that on the front burner of their attention. I'm realizing that I did not drop a second MCLE passphrase into the show, so I'll do that right now, and I'm going to make it notice and stay down back from our discussion on Dropbox, so that if you have to demonstrate that you, in fact, listened to or watched the show, now you have two ways of showing that, yes, indeed, you did. Evan, it's been great chatting with you as well. Lots of Chicago stories in our rundown today. Hotbed of legal developments there where you are.
Yeah, well, it's a great place to be. Always interesting things going on. So, yeah, it was a pleasure to participate in the conversation with you about them. Nancy, really nice to meet you. Like I said at the start of the show, great to put a face with the Twitter presence, and look forward to staying in touch.
Thanks. I was really happy to be here.
Good deal.
And Evan and I are going to go off and do some snacking now, go find our Nature Box boxes and go nom, nom, nom. I really am. It's right over in the kitchen and it's calling my name. All right. So everyone, we have so enjoyed spending this time with you. We do this every Friday at 11 o'clock. If you'd like to join us live, 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC is when we record the show live. You can jump on into our IRC at irc.twit.tv if you are joining us live. If not, never fear. The show is going to be available for you on demand with no windowing whatsoever. It goes right up as soon as we've got it ready for you. And that's at twit.tv/twill and also at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. On iTunes, if you subscribe to things there. It's on your Roku box and many, many other outlets if you're interested in other ways that you can subscribe to This Week in Law. Head on over to our show page and there's more information for you there. Also, between the shows, we love hearing from you. In fact, we really couldn't do the show without your suggestions and heads up for things that have caught your eye and guests that you think would be interesting for us to talk to. So do get in touch with us. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. We're both on Twitter. I'm D Howell over there. Evan is Internet Cases there. And we have Google Plus and Facebook pages for the show, where it's a little bit more easy to have a conversation, though we do that on Twitter as well. So we're really glad that you could join us. We look forward to seeing you next week on This Week in Law. And until then, please take care. Bye-bye.